The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So today I thought I'd talk about kind of how our lives are constructed and how we can watch this in our, in particular in our daily lives. I thought about this because of thinking about going home for the holidays and how easy it is to be pulled into old habits and patterns when we visit family. And so I kind of wound my way back thinking about that. I'll touch on that a little towards the end of the talk, hopefully. But just to kind of set up some context about how to work with that, how to practice with that. And I think this all comes back to this kind of way that our lives are constructed, comes back to the fact that our bodies and minds are so intimately tied together. They are things that happen in our body impact what happens in our minds. Things we see, things we hear, things we feel influences what's happening in our minds. You know, something unpleasant happens, we have a reaction. Something pleasant happens, we like it, we want it. We see something, we're a friend, perhaps, you know, you're somewhere and you see a friend and an emotion arises of, oh, delight or happiness to see your friend. So there's the contact with the world through our senses, and this impacts our minds. And then there's things that happen in our minds, and those in turn impact our body. You know, an emotion of delight arises, and it kind of ripples through it. It is rippled through the body. We feel it in the body. Emotion of anger arises and it impacts our body. So there's this kind of mutual back and forth between body and mind. And the kind of point of connection between body and mind is, at least in the Buddhist psychology, is a factor of mind called volition. That we, everything that we do has a volition that comes with it. So this movement, there's a volition in the mind that precedes the movement. And this is one of the kind of first, or there's a text, Dhammapada, that has a very famous first poem. It says, everything that we experience is led by mind, created by mind. And so that factor of volition is kind of the mental factor that animates our lives. And then the poem goes on, a speaker act with a mind that is contracted and tight, and suffering follows. Speaker act with a mind that is open and receptive, not greed, not corrupted or not influenced by greed, aversion, delusion, then happiness follows. And so this point of volition, volition itself is kind of a neutral thing. It's just this animating quality. But it's always accompanied by some motivation or some, you know, it's influenced or directed by some motivation. Those motivations have flavors to them, as this poem suggests. Speaker act with a heart that's contracted, a mind that's contracted by greed, by aversion, by delusion. That heads our mind in one direction. If we speak or act with a heart that's influenced by love, by compassion, by generosity, it tends to move our hearts in another direction. By non-greed, by non-aversion, by non-delusion, it moves our hearts towards more happiness. It moves our experience towards more happiness. And so these the body-mind connection through this point of volition, and then that volition is in turn influenced by the states of mind and heart. And this, these two together are called in the Buddhist teaching, they're called, it's a long word. In the Pali, it's sankharas, and translated as something like volitional formations. Those things that come into our mind, emotions are volitional formations, thoughts are volitional formations. States of mind such as peace or ease or concentration are volitional formations. So this is a broad category, this idea of volitional formations. And so these volitional formations, the word in Pali, sankhara, is used to refer both to the fact that these volitional formations are formed, you know, so you might see somebody and a friend, you see a friend, there's that contact with the eye, you see that person, and because of that, there's delight that arises. And so that volitional formation is constructed, it's formed through this process of contact with the senses. And so the volitional formations refers to those things that are constructed, that are formed. But it also refers to the fact that these formations, these volitional formations, form other things. So anger, for instance, forms or shapes how we receive experience in the world. It shapes how we feel about experience. So something like anger, for instance, will impact what our body even looks like. It has that kind of impact on our system that when there's anger, often it's expressed through how our face is appearing. It can create a tightness and tension in the body, pressure and heat. So the mental formation of anger in turn forms other experience. So there's both parts of when we talk about volitional formations, it's both sides. It's both the fact that things are formed and that they are constructing and forming experience. So we can start to explore this in daily life, and this is kind of a little bit of the topic that I'd like to explore today, is this question of formations and how we both see them happening in our daily lives. We can see this and see how they kind of tumble us forward. It's the process, volition and the kind of associated motivation are the process that shapes our lives. This is how our lives unfold in a particular direction. And so we can begin to see this process at work and understand how to, first of all, just watch it, see it unfolding, and through that process of watching it, learn how not to automatically follow through on some of those less fruitful formations, you know, how we can see, anger's arising, and boy, this is kind of tumbling me forward into saying something. But when we see it with mindfulness, there's the possibility of choice to not allow it to express itself through action in the body. And so we can, with mindfulness, begin to kind of redirect the flow of our lives in another direction. And we can also, through this process of choice, begin to choose how to more skillfully construct our experience. And so this is a huge topic, and we'll see how far we get today. I kind of mostly wanted to talk about it with respect to looking at it in daily life. How do we get familiar with this process in daily life, and how can we start to navigate what we see around these constructors, both what is constructed and the constructing itself. And so I'd like to explore a little bit about the fact that they're talked about as constructors, these volitional formations, that they're forming, they form our experience. There's one teaching that says that this process of volitional formation impacts every part of our experience. So it impacts, so as I talked about just a moment ago, I'll go a little more into depth into the, like an example around anger. So it impacts our body, how our body looks, how it feels, the tightness, the contraction. So it impacts the body. It also impacts how we feel. So when there is anger, often the experience feels unpleasant. So there's that aspect of our experience that is constructed by the anger. How we feel, whether things feel pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, is impacted by these volitional formations. When we feel peace or ease, it tends to have more of a pleasant quality in our experience. These volitional formations, so anger, for instance, tends to construct more anger. That's not a big surprise, but it's, you know, we can see this process whipping up in our minds. If we don't see the anger and recognize, oh, this is anger, the process of anger tends to keep fueling itself. I talk about this story a lot, you know, that early in my practice, I was using anger as a kind of a wake-up bell and starting to explore it in daily life. And the very first times I became aware of it, my intention was, I'm going to wake up to this anger happening in daily life. And the very first times I became aware of it, the mind had already gone so far down the constructing path of anger that it was in a rage. And, you know, it's like waking up to that is like, wow, this is really unpleasant. You know, it's like, yes, the rage had constructed unpleasantness. The more I paid attention to that, the earlier and earlier in the process of that constructing, I woke up. And there was more capacity to be able to be with it. The earlier I woke up in it, it's more like a normal anger and not a rage. A little bit unpleasant. Not this kind of mind kind of spun out of control. So the constructing power of these formations tends to construct formations. And so the anger tends to construct anger. Or sometimes anger constructs fear. Or fear constructs confusion. Or confusion constructs fear. And so we can watch in our experience how these mental constructions like interweave and layer on top of each other. And then there are also these wholesome mind states, love. Love, the state of love, it tends to feel unconstricted, it tends to feel pleasant. The open heart has a kind of a pleasant feeling to it. And in that space of the open heart, there's the quality of the feeling of the love. There's often a softening on the face, and so it's constructing the face and the body, feeling more soft and open. And then what it meets in the world, when that heart that's open meets someone who's delighted and, you know, sees a baby giggling, you know, it's like the heart is going to produce joy. So that place of the open heart, of the connected heart, that mental formation of love, when the in the world there's joy and delight, the heart tends to construct joy and delight. If the what happens in the world is that the heart sees or meets suffering, when that heart is open, what is tends to be constructed when there is suffering in the world is compassion. And so these, both the wholesome, the beautiful qualities of mind, and the unwholesome tend to construct. And this is that first statement of the Dhammapada. I'll see if I can remember Gill's translation. Let's see. All we experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All we experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful heart, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So the wholesome constructions, the peaceful, the open-hearted, love, generosity, kindness, compassion, peace, calm, tranquility, tend to construct ease in our lives. More of those. This constructive power, as I said, it constructs everything. It's like it has fingers. These constructors have fingers into all parts of our experience. And this is kind of mind-blowing when we start to see it. Because what we start to see is that, you know, some, and again, I'll use an example of anger because it can be something that we can possibly see or you know, be familiar with. As I talk about it, you may recognize some of this in your experience. As we take in, as we feel a particular mind state such as anger, it tends to have us perceiving experience in a certain way. And so, you know, the way we meet experience, we see somebody, we take them in, we, you know, in, it's like we have an idea about who they are. And when we have a lens or a filter such as anger, you know, we may tend to interpret that person's actions or facial expressions, perceive them as being hostile or angry or indifferent. So it's not so likely when we're in a state of anger that we would perceive somebody as being open and connected with us, because our mind is in a space of being closed. And so we're taking in information through this filter. We're actually perceiving things in the world differently because of the filters. This has huge impact on our lives, how we meet experience, how we take things in, what we interpret happening in the world. So influenced by our states of mind. And not only how we perceive things, but that we perceive things, or what we actually perceive, is influenced by these formations. This one is harder to recognize because we do, you know, we do think, I mean, we think that we're wandering the world and we've got like these cameras for eyes and microphones for ears and we're just kind of taking everything in just exactly as it's out there. But what's going on in our minds is like creating these warp mirrors and distorted sound filters on how we're taking in information. And so we perceive things differently. And not only that, some things we perceive and some things we don't perceive. So our sensory apparatus is very influenceable by our state of mind. Often influenced by emotions, as with the example of anger, but also influenced by agenda, by our views and opinions. The best example I can give for this, it's hard to describe how it's even possible that, you know, we might not take something in through our sense doors. You know, that you know, if we're I had an example of this just the other day. I was at IRC, and there was a place, you know, I used to go into IRC every day when I teach retreat there, and I'd hang up my coat on this coat rack. And I went in there that day, and it's like there was a refrigerator where there had been a coat rack. I was like, oh, the coat rack's gone. And I glanced around the room, and it's like, there's no coat rack here. So I put my coat on a table. This went on for like 3-4 days. And I talked to Gil about, you know, I think we need to get some coat hooks. You know, we lost our coat rack thing. He said, oh, it's down there. I said, no, it's gone. But that made me think, I did look around the room, but I went back down to that room, and the coat rack was on the other side of the room. It was there. I would have sworn that it was not there. Partly this is the way my mind works about, like, you know, kind of, it's a very focused kind of mind. And so it will tend to, it will look for something where it's used to seeing it. If it doesn't see it, it'll glance around, but the expectation that it's not there is so strong, it doesn't see it. There's a, and just so that you don't think it's just my mind that does this, some of you may have heard about this study kind of explored this. This is called, it's a phenomenon of mine called selective attention, that we will see certain things and not other things. And the study created an agenda through which people would see their experience and to see whether this, you know, how this impacted what they saw. And so they were asked to watch a video and to watch people passing a basketball between people in a white shirt. There were people in different colored shirts, but they were asked to count the number of times the basketball passed between the players in the white shirt. And so they did that, and pretty much without exception, the people could answer the question. So how many times did the basketball change hands between those players? So they were doing the task. They were taking in the information from the video and doing something with it. A very few people in that study also commented on saying something like, "What was there like a gorilla, a guy in a gorilla suit in that video?" And other people, you know, were like, no, you know, there wasn't. But there had been, actually. A guy in a gorilla suit came out through the players and had, you know, stood there very obviously. It's like you're not going to miss the gorilla if you're looking for a gorilla. But if you're not looking for a gorilla and you're attending to something else, you do not see the gorilla. Many, many people did not see the gorilla. In fact, the delusion, like me, when Gil said, oh yeah, the coat rack is down there, I was like, no, the coat rack isn't there. And like that, the mind so believing its perceptions and its what it has seen, the people who, when shown the video, after they'd been told there's going to be a gorilla in the video, of course you see the gorilla. I mean, I've watched this video. It's like, you're not going to miss the gorilla. They said, this is a different video. They did not believe it could possibly be the same video because they had not seen the gorilla the first time and it's so obvious the second time. This is the power not only of our mind's ability to screen things in and out, to take in information. This is based on an agenda. You know, this isn't like some major like emotional thing. This is a small agenda to take in how many times a basketball passes. How many agendas do we walk through our days with? that this is screening in some things to see, to know, and not other things. It's really mind-blowing when we take this in. And then our delusive capacity that we have that, no, actually I am seeing things completely clearly. This, no, it's a different video. So our mental formations, and mental formations includes things like thoughts, like agendas, like views, like beliefs. Mental formations includes that stuff, much of which is below the level of our conscious awareness. These construct not only other mental formations, but how we perceive, how we feel, what we know. The power of these mental formations is phenomenal. And when we're not aware of them, they're rolling along, doing their thing, influencing everything that we see, that we know, that we think, that we feel, that we perceive, without our consciously recognizing it. The power of mindfulness here is not that we immediately can recognize, oh, mental formation, stop this, anger mental formation and create a love mental formation, but that we can recognize, that we even know the possibility that these formations influence so much of our lives. We can begin to be aware and recognizing the power, for instance, of the constructing aspect of anger, begin to intervene with not acting on it, not following through with action. Using the construction of mindfulness. Mindfulness is also one of these constructing things, one of these mental formations. We can turn the power of mindfulness to experience, and it begins to turn the battleship around. It begins to turn move the direction from the just unconsciously tumbling forward in these mental formations to knowing what's happening in our minds. So these, another piece I want to just bring in here, because it's not just about our own personal views and opinions here. Our views, our agendas, our opinions are constructed. They are constructors, but they are also constructed. These views, opinions, agendas are constructed by how we've kind of come through the world. They're constructed based on things we've seen, things we've done, kind of impersonal aspects of our lives. They're constructed by how our families were. So there's, kind of intergenerational aspects to these constructions of views, beliefs, opinions. There are, peer influences. So it's not only that these constructions are arising inside here, but they are arising with respect to our environment. How other people are, what they say, what they think, what they do, influences our views, opinions, beliefs. Our culture has a huge forming power on what our beliefs are, what our opinions are, what our views are. And, one of the, actually culture, one way we could define culture or, what a culture is as a kind of a set of shared views, shared beliefs, shared opinions. And those kind, we can start to see, how that agenda of counting the number of basketballs, passing, how much that influenced how we took in the world. And that was just one little, agenda dropped in. But when we, and we can begin to recognize, okay, that's an agenda. Let me shift the agenda. Let's see if I can see things from a different perspective. But when we are unaware that we are carrying a perspective, and so much with culture we're unaware that we're carrying the perspective because largely the people that we mostly hang out with share those opinions, those views. And so it's not understood as a perspective, it's understood as the truth. So this is a particularly potent form of mental formation. Those formations that we share collectively with our families, with our friends, with our culture. There are so many hidden cultural perspectives that have such a broad impact on the suffering of the world. I mean, right now, there's so much happening around the race relations in our society, in our culture, and in America right now. So much around that. And, you know, it's a lot of what's happening is around a unseen perspective, an unseen sense that, well, for instance, just for many white Americans, an African American male can be perceived as frightening at a very kind of quick level. And this is, you know, what's happening with the shootings and the the police officers, you know, quickly responding to African American men, the African American men dying, is kind of the tip of the iceberg of just this kind of perspective that's shot through our whole the whole kind of white American culture. And we don't see it so much. We don't see that perspective, and we don't see how it influences us. So what our practice can do is begin to help us to recognize, okay, yes, this is a perspective. It's like this is a delusion. This is a confusion of mind that's has this perspective so hidden that it's taking in information in this way. And one of the ones that was I heard of several events over the last few months, and one was a person, an African American man, filling up his car at a gas station, and a police officer comes up to him and asks him for his ID. And first of all, it's like, you know, how often is a white person asked for their ID at a gas station? You know, that's right there. You know, that's already a filter of a perspective that there's, you know, you're seeing something threatening. It's just like somebody's filling up a gas. And so the man, like, sure, reached in his car to get his identification. And the police officer had the perspective that he was going for a gun, and he shot him. This kind of thing is this filter of formation, a filter of a kind of an underlying fear that influences how we perceive things. The fact that we can start to see this, we can start to open to this, we can start to recognize, right, okay, this view in the mind is a mental formation. It's influencing how I'm perceiving. It is possible, actually, through mindfulness, to begin to untangle some of these deep, culturally conditioned habits. I think it's imperative that we do that. I really do feel that what we learn, how we learn to explore in our own lives, these agendas, these conditionings will have, it has the capacity to have a huge ripple effect throughout the world by being willing to explore this, to look at this. And so I also want to talk from the other perspective. I'm mostly talking about how our mental formations like get in the way of seeing clearly and kind of influences take us down the path towards reactivity and suffering. There's also the, as I said earlier, the wholesome mental constructions, the love and compassion and mindfulness and concentration and generosity and wisdom. We can cultivate these. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about what it's like to be with those experiences and what happens as they happen. You know, I started exploring the you know, love as a constructor, you know, influencing how our body is, our receptivity to the world, the open-hearted place of love meeting suffering and responding with compassion rather than fear or confusion. The open-hearted meeting of somebody who's having success and being happy in response rather than feeling, why not me? So the possibility of these beautiful states of mind also constructing in another direction. And we can also, I think one of the great, let's see, how much time do I have? One of the great constructions, I'm just going to touch on this just really briefly. One of the great constructions of the mind is the sense of self. This is also a construction, the perspective of I am, the perspective of me doing something, is a construction of the mind. And that construction is often not seen. It's often just assumed as being true. And so much of our, because that's not seen, that's like even an even lower level of kind of unseen perspective than even our cultural conditioning is this perspective of self. It's like a human. It's a human conditioning. It's a human conditioning that we have this perspective of I am. It comes very early, very deeply. And so, you know, if it's not seen, and it's possible to, you know, of course we don't usually see that sense of self, but that sense of self tends to be one of the main things that constructs. I'm the kind of person who needs this. And we go off to get that. You know, if we don't question this sense of I am as a construction or a view or a perspective, we're just going to be led down the garden path of what that sense of self wants and needs and thinks is important. And yet, even with a rudimentary kind of curiosity and recognition about that sense of self, we all, in our practice, use that sense of self to turn the mind in a more wholesome way. The sense of self is a construction in the mind. And, you know, it's like rather than thinking, oh, I need to get rid of that, it's more like, how can I use that construction? Because it's going to be constructing. Is there a way to use that construction of sense of self to reorient our mind? We all do this when we sit down to meditate. We turn our attention. We use a sense of self. I am going to sit down and meditate. This is a wholesome use of the sense of self. The sense of self has a way that we have a sense that I'm choosing, I'm deciding, I'm doing. And we can use that to choose to cultivate mindfulness, concentration, compassion. So One of the really beautiful explorations, again, connecting to mind and body, is that, you know, these mental formations are so deeply practiced and deeply conditioned that even as we start to become mindful of them, you know, we recognize, yeah, I see anger's arising. It's not like I can go, okay, turn off anger and turn on love. You know, the mind doesn't do that. It's not that amenable to just switches like that. And yet what there is a possibility of doing, coming back to this connection between body and mind, is to recognize that, okay, anger is arising. And not having any sense of needing to try to turn it off. In fact, actually recognizing, opening, yes, that anger is here. But then seeing if it might be possible to have the intention, so coming back to that sense of volition, have the intention first to not act out of that anger or that challenging, and not act out of fear, not act out of confusion, not act out of impatience, but kind of see, can I allow that feeling, but not let it leak out into my body, into the expression of the body. This points to that point of connection between mind and body. Again, volition, that point of connection between mind and body. Even when there is a mental tumbling forward of a difficult, challenging, reactive emotion, if mindfulness comes during that, if mindfulness doesn't come, then it is going to be expressing in our body. It is going to be influencing our feelings and our perceptions. It's going to be constructing more anger. And yet when mindfulness comes into the picture, the possibility of influencing the actions of the body, our actions of the body are way more subject to conscious control than our mental formations. So while we can't turn off the switch of anger and replace it with love in our minds, we sometimes, and not even always, but sometimes have the capacity to say, yes, that's there. I'm not going to act from it. I'm not going to speak from it. Because the activity of body is a kind of it's more amenable to conscious control, conscious choice, than our states of mind are. And so, using that understanding, we can, through when seeing something like a reactive emotion, like anger, we can choose to not repress the feeling, not repress that, but also see if we cannot express it through the body. And if at the same time we can explore, so that right there is wholesome, to not allow the anger to kind of carry out into the world physically. That right there is a wholesome state of mind, of non-harming. And we can also potentially hold the intention to express peace or ease through the body, even as we're feeling anger or impatience, or confusion. So an example of this, the clearest one, I mean, it's kind of like it's sometimes challenging giving Dharma talks because to come up with good examples, often in our practice, it's like, the first time we see something really clearly, it sears itself on our mind. It's right there. And yet, then we see it a lot of other times, but it's not like, you know, we remember that. So I'll tell, like, the first time again, I'll tell this story. This is a story I've told before, of course, but, you know, it was so clear. This was so clear that it has just seared itself on my mind. And so it's easy to describe and easy to pull apart the threads of what happened. So I was practicing one period of time exploring impatience in my mind, looking at the many ways I felt it in daily life. I was not just on the cushion, but in daily life. And it was everywhere. You know, it happened when I was brushing my teeth. It happened when I was walking down the sidewalk and had something to do. And it happened in the grocery store. And it happened in the drugstore. And I began to notice that when I was impatient, it expressed itself through the body. In the drugstore, it expressed itself by throwing things into the basket. Going through the drugstore and picking up things. So I noticed that. I'd been observing this impatience for quite a while and began seeing, okay, how does it leak out into the body? And at that moment in the drugstore, I decided to take on this practice that I was just describing. Can I feel the impatience, but not let it leak out into my behavior? Might that be possible? And the way I chose to interact with that or to do that was to consciously slow down my actions, picking things up off the shelf, placing them in the basket, even as I felt the impatience in the mind. So that intention was not only to not act on the impatience, but also to cultivate the possibility of, can I act with patience? And I found that it was possible. And through that process of not repressing the impatience, feeling it, but changing the behavior, within about a minute, the impatience vanished. It just went away. Now, I'm not saying that every experience, every time you explore something like that, it will change what's happening in your mind. But this practice of cultivating the wholesome through how we engage in the world with the intention, it's the intention of, okay, I'm going to move through the world in a way that expresses peace, in a way that expresses kindness, even if I'm not feeling it. Not trying to repress this requires really being truthful. So not repressing the impatience with drivers on the road or the frustration with somebody cutting you off, but, you know, slowing down, backing off, you know, not letting it come out in expressions or gestures, with the intention of cultivating peace, it will have an impact on your mind. How we behave rebounds on our minds. We have about 4 minutes, and I think I'm going to use that to share a poem rather than opening it to discussion. But I'll just put this out here, because this, to me, is a kind of a teaching from the Buddha. Just about this very thing, he describes in this is an old text. It's called the Chapter of the Eights, and it's 16 poems that describe what it's a set of poems around clinging, and what it's like for a person who clings, who has contention with the world. It has a set of poems that describe what their life is like, how they engage with the world. Then it has a set of poems that describes what it's like for somebody who's let go of clinging, who's free, who has an open heart. And then it's got a set of poems, so there's three categories of poems. The last category of poems is, and how do you get from one to the other? How do you move from being that person who's caught and struggling to being that person who's free? And I'm going to read first a little bit from the poems about what a person who's free. And it's kind of noteworthy, I think, in this poem that the description is very much a description of how the person is in the world. It's not a description of like being some transcendent being floating in space. It's really engaged. And so here's the question from the questioner. Having what vision, being of what character is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person. Here's a few excerpts from this. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not selfish, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not conceited, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous and not bored. A person who does not cling to the future nor sorrow over the past, who finds seclusion amidst sense contacts and is not led astray by views. A person who is even-tempered, constantly mindful, who does not suppose that anyone in the world is his equal, better, or lesser, who is free of conceit. This is someone I call peaceful. And then the description of how to get there. Someone again asks the Buddha, speak about the path of practice. How do we practice? And here is the description of how to practice. You may recognize some of this may be sound familiar. A person should not have covetous eyes, should close one's ear to ordinary chatter, should not be greedy for flavors, should not cherish anything in the world. Being meditative, one should not be footloose, should desist from worrying, not be indolent, should not be given to oversleeping, should be given to wakefulness. One should not fear blame, nor should one be conceited when praised. One should not be a boaster, should not speak scheming words, should not make a habit of impudence, should not utter quarrelsome speech. One should not be moved to tell lies, should not be deliberately treacherous, should not despise others for their way of life, for their wisdom, or their moral conduct or religious practices. If contemplatives or ordinary people irritate one with their talkativeness, one should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. So to me, what this is pointing to is modeling where we're trying to go. Using the behavior of one who is free as a guide and taking that on as a practice. If you want to be peaceful, don't repress non-peacefulness, but behave peacefully. That will begin to transform the mind. And so here's my suggestion for you going home to families, to being with people, if you're going to be with people on holidays or just engaging with people in the world at this time of year when there's so much busyness, and act peacefully. Be peaceful in your body with the hope that it might soften the heart. So that's all the time we have. Thank you for your attention.